It is important for us to be careful in what we say to those who are grieving. And that includes what we say when we speak to people at a funeral home, but it includes what we say long after the funeral is over, too, because the grief doesn't stop when the funeral is over. While some people may have good intentions with what they say, there are times that we just flat out use poorly chosen words that end up being hurtful rather than helpful. I've been guilty of that myself, and I've had to be more careful of what I say and how I say it. In your bulletin today, there's an article which some of the things we're going to look at here in just a moment, but there's 10 examples of cliches or platitudes that are often said in conversations with the grieving that we should avoid and consider replacing. We avoid them because though they are meant to comfort, they often do not. And it'd be better for us to say nothing than to say something that's hurtful in a difficult moment. And so, following loss and death, you might consider not saying something like this: well, you must be relieved. Sometimes we say that. You must be relieved. A person who thinks that death brings relief, you've probably perhaps not sorted through a will. You haven't had to call life insurance companies. You haven't had to go to the courthouse and get a death certificate. You haven't had to deal with how to settle an estate. You haven't had to deal with the financial and family decisions that often follow. Death is not always a relief. Be careful what you say. Sometimes we say something like, well, I understand how you feel, or I know how you feel. I can't say that to a widow. I've never lost a spouse, so I can't really understand or know how they feel. I can't say that to someone who's lost a parent. I have not lost any of my parents yet. So even if I have, my situation may be different than their situation, so I can't really say I know how they feel. We should be careful about saying that. Sometimes we say, well, it will get better. It just takes time. I know people who have lost their loved ones, and it just never seemed to get better. We can't be sure that that's the case, and so we need to be careful of offering false hope. Sometimes we say, well, you just need to accept this and just move on, as if, your grief timeline should be their grief timeline. And when we say that, it dismisses their grief as unimportant. We need to be careful about saying that. Say things like, well, every cloud has a silver lining. That sounds good on a Hallmark card, but that can come across wrong in the moment. Sometimes we can't see the silver lining in the moment. Be careful of that. Definitely don't say to somebody, well, you shouldn't feel that way. Sometimes we're grieving, we're angry. Sometimes it goes from anger to sadness. And sometimes we are sometimes irrational in our thinking, but you don't tell people how to feel because we just can't control how we feel. So don't tell somebody how they have to feel. We say things like, God only takes the good ones, or only the good die young, or things like that. First of all, we're not the judge. We don't know who God takes and who God doesn't take and why God takes. And then it sounds like we're blaming God for why this death has occurred. And that's not a true representation of death, because good and bad people die alike at all stages of life. I mean, Matthew chapter 5 says that the rain falls on the good and the evil. The sun shines on the just and the unjust. So it's not even an accurate statement. We say things like, they're better off now. Well, again, we're not the judge. And even if that was the case, maybe we're not ready to hear it. Maybe we think we're worse off without our loved one. And so we're not ready to hear something like that. Or you hear something that's similar to this, it could have been worse. Could have been worse. You lost a child, but at least you didn't lose your whole family. Could have been worse. Or we say things like, well, at least you had your father until you were 40 years old. I lost mine when I was 12. It could have been worse. Don't say something like that. It makes the situation about you instead of about them, and it doesn't remove the grief. Or this is one of the worst things that I've heard, and that people don't say this per se, but they deserve to die. No, I've never heard someone say those words, but I've heard people say stuff like this. Well, I knew they needed to quit smoking. Well, I knew they were overeating. I told them they needed to start exercising. That's like saying, I told you so, after you've died. What good does that do? It's very distasteful. So there's things that we need to not say to people at funerals and to people when they're grieving. And hopefully, this is kind of a sermon within a sermon right here, but hopefully we can see the wisdom of being more careful in the words that we choose as we speak to those who are in grief. But despite all that I've just said, one of the biggest violators of this principle is Jesus himself. Now, we can't accuse Jesus of any ill will here. We can't accuse Jesus of being wrong. He was sinless. But there's two things that Jesus says in Luke chapter 7 that only Jesus could get away with saying. And those two things would make the list, if it were us, of things not to say at a funeral. But we're going to make an exception for Jesus this morning, and you're going to see why here in just a moment. Let's read the text, Luke chapter 7, verse 11. It says, "Now it happened the day after that he went into a city called Nain, and many of his disciples went with him in a large crowd. And when he came near the gate of the city, behold, a dead man was being carried out, the only son of his mother, and she was a widow. And a large crowd from the city was with her. And when the Lord saw her, he had compassion on her and said to her, 'Do not weep.' Then he came and touched the open coffin, and those who carried him stood still. And he said, 'Young man, I say to you, arise.' And so he who was dead sat up and began to speak. And he presented him to his mother. And then fear came upon all, and they glorified God, saying, 'A great prophet has risen up among us, and God has visited his people.' And this report about him went throughout all Judea and all the surrounding region." Now, I want you to picture the situation here. There are two large crowds in Luke chapter 7. One of those very large crowds, as we've seen in the context of Luke over and over again, there were multitudes of people following Jesus. And this is no exception on this day. One of those large crowds is following Jesus, who is the exciting miracle worker. He is the master teacher. And so they are hanging upon the words of Jesus, just waiting in anticipation as to what he might do or say next. But there's another crowd. It seems like the entire city of Nain is with a mother who's a widow, who has just lost her only son. This crowd is following the coffin of a young man as he is being carried, perhaps by the pallbearers, to his final resting place. Now, funerals were different back in the time of Jesus than they were now. Funerals are different from culture to culture. When we think of carrying someone to their final resting place, a lot of times we think of the hearse and we think of the casket and we think of the long line of cars, perhaps, that's following that hearse as it gets moved from the church or from the funeral home to the cemetery. But funerals in the time of Christ were not quite like that. A lot of the funerals that I attend, they're very quiet as well. People just very quietly sit, and sometimes they're very somber. That's not true of all cultures, but generally, most of the funerals I've been to, that is typically how the funeral is. Very quiet at the burial. But that wasn't always the case in first century funerals. Sometimes people were very loudly wailing and lamenting. They expressed their emotions differently than perhaps we do in our culture sometimes. And so there are sometimes even paid mourners, people who are hired to lament and mourn. Sometimes there were people playing music, and it was a music of lamentation as this person would be carried to their final resting place. And so not only that, but funerals generally happened in the first century within 24 hours. We can understand why. They didn't have some of the same procedures that we have for embalming bodies. And so they needed to bury the body quickly. And so you didn't have as many days to prepare yourself mentally. If you were the mother of this son, this would be all happen within a 24-hour turnaround. Your son, you find out, has died. And then you, within 24 hours, would be burying your son with most of the rest of the city in the cemetery or in the tombs outside of the city. And so you can imagine how this widow must have felt in this moment. She's grieving, she perplexed, perhaps just in a daze. Sometimes we're just in a daze, we're in a stare. There's so much going on around us. There's so much commotion. And here we are, we're thinking about what has just happened. We're thinking about what will happen. And so there's a large crowd of people with this woman as she mourns. And this large crowd of people following the coffin runs into this large crowd of people. I would say they are providentially intersecting, and they pass one another. And suddenly Jesus sees what's going on, that his crowd is running into another crowd, and he merges into the funeral crowd, and he sees the grieving widow, and he says something that you are not allowed to say at a funeral, and you are not allowed to say to anyone who's grieving. He says, "Don't cry. Don't cry." Can you imagine the audacity of a statement like "don't cry" in a widow's most acute state of fragility? She's already lost her husband. Now she's lost her only son, and she's grief-stricken on the way to the grave. Her means of stability and support in first century culture was gone. There wasn't a social security check that was going to come in later. Many of the women in the first century didn't work. They didn't have a means of support. She has a dreadful and a pervasive loneliness ahead. She doesn't have a husband in the home with her now. She doesn't have any other children except this one son. And can you imagine the eerie quietness of the house once the son was gone? Her son is on the verge of being laid to his final resting place, never to be seen again. Can you imagine how words like "don't cry" at such a time would anger most people immediately, and it would come back to haunt that person when the house had gone silent? But while most people would be branded to say something like that as careless, as tactless, as foolish, Jesus is commended by Luke. Jesus, Luke says, had compassion on her. And so we consider the tone of voice with which Jesus might have said it. Consider most importantly the reason why Jesus could say it. Luke says he said it with compassion. "Don't weep." It doesn't sound compassionate when we hear that, but then notice Jesus goes and says something else that only a crazy man would say at a funeral. After he says this, he goes up and touches the coffin. I think that's an important slight point to make. A lot of people who believe that Jesus would have made himself unclean by doing this, Jesus never sinned. And you notice that Luke doesn't say he touched the dead body, he touched the coffin. Uncleanness came by touching the body. It didn't come by touching the coffin. And so he touches the coffin. And after he touches the coffin, he says, "Young Man, I say to you, arise. Can you imagine the lunacy of interrupting a funeral, speaking to the corpse, and then telling the deceased to get up out of the coffin? We would start calling, right, security. If this were to happen at any other funeral, we would start telling the people who work the funeral home, there is a crazy stranger who just came in here, and I want them escorted out because they're speaking to my deceased child. This would be considered extremely offensive at any other funeral in any other country, because it's sheer craziness to crash a funeral like this, to touch the open coffin and then begin speaking to the dead. But in Luke 7 and verse 15, it says this, and here's why Jesus could say it. So he who was dead sat up and began to speak, and Jesus presented he who was dead to his mother. Now, why is it that Jesus is the only one who can say these two things? Well, hopefully the answer is pretty obvious here as to why he could say this. We couldn't say it. But the onlooking crowd, they're not upset with Jesus for having done what he's just done. In fact, their response after the young man has risen from the dead, is presented to his mother, their response is that a great prophet has risen up among us. They know something unique has happened. They also say the Lord has visited his people, which is something that was said way back in Luke chapter 1 when John the Baptist was born. Zacharias and Elizabeth say the Lord has visited his people. Why? Because John the Baptist was going to prepare the way for the Lord who would save his people. And now the people know that indeed Jesus is the one that John was preparing the way for. Jesus is the great prophet who was to come. I want you to think about a couple of things, though, that I find interesting as we think about this text. Many of the Jews would have been familiar with another great prophet, really two great prophets, who had performed similar miracles. I want you to go back to 1 Kings chapter 17 and notice verses 17 through 24. Why is it that they would come to the conclusion that Jesus must be a great prophet? Well, I think that there's something reminiscent in what we see in Luke chapter 7 that the Jews were already familiar with from the Old Testament. And that is Elijah, one of the great prophets, had performed a similar miracle in 1 Kings 17. The text says this, and there's a really awesome context, but I'm just trying to keep it within the confines of the miracle itself. It says, it happened after these things that the son of the woman who owned the house became sick. Now, this is a house that Elijah had stayed in, and he had been fed in this home, and these people had been very hospitable to him as he had done his prophetic work. And yet here he is staying in a house, the great prophet of the Lord, and the son of the woman who owned the house is sick. And his sickness was so serious that there was no breath left in him. He was near death. So she said to Elijah, "What have I to do with you, O man of God? Have you come to me to bring my sin to remembrance and to kill my son?" She starts to get upset. She's already beginning the grieving process. Why is it I'm losing my son? I'm being kind to you, hospitable to you. You're staying in my home. I'm feeding you. And yet this is what's happening to me? I would think good things should be happening to me. Why is this bad thing happening to me? Why is my son about to die? And he said to her, "Give me your son," in verse 19. And so he took him out of her arms and carried him up to the upper room where he was staying and laid him on his own bed. And then Elijah cried out to the Lord and said, "O Lord, my God, have you also brought tragedy on the widow with whom I lodged?" This was a difficult time in the history of Israel. Prophets were being killed. They were hiding. Israel was being persecuted by Ahab. And here Elijah says, "Are you also bringing tragedy on this poor widow. Notice who she is. A widow with whom I lodge. By killing her son? And he stretched himself out on the child three times and cried out to the Lord and said, O Lord, my God, I pray, let this child's soul come back to him. And then the Lord heard the voice of Elijah, and the soul of the child came back to him, and he revived. And Elijah took the child, brought him down from the upper room into the house, and gave him to his mother. Doesn't this sound so familiar? You have a widow. You have the widow's son. The widow's son is sick. And then you have a prophet, and the prophet prays to God, asks for healing, and after the child is healed, he brings the child back to his mother and presents the child alive and well. That'd ring a bell a little bit with you if you were a Jew and familiar with that story. And then Jesus has just done something incredibly familiar. And Elijah says, see, your son lives. Now notice, by the way, the conclusion of the woman. She's kind of upset with Elijah when this is first happening, but it says in verse 24, the woman said to Elijah, now by this I know that you are a man of God and that the word of the Lord in your mouth is the truth. What was the purpose of the miracle? Certainly there was the compassion of the Lord upon this woman who had been so good to his prophet. But the purpose of the miracle ultimately is to prove that indeed Elijah is a prophet and does possess the power of God, and what he says you can trust. So in this account, Elijah prays to the Lord so a child might be brought back to life, and the result is the son's mother has faith in the man of God. But there's a second one. There's a second similar instance, and it's in 2 Kings chapter 4, and we find it with Elisha. Elisha is the prophet who replaced Elijah. And Elisha is called in 2 Kings 4 to come attend, this time to a deceased child of a Shunammite woman. So the first child with Elijah was a child that was near to death. The second child in 2 Kings 4 was a child who indeed had died. There's some really interesting similarities, by the way, between Elijah and John the Baptist, and then Elisha and Jesus. Elisha performs twice as many miracles as Elijah ever does. He's a greater prophet than Elijah. Jesus performs far more miracles and does far more than John the Baptist ever does. He is the greatest of all prophets. He indeed is the Son of God. But notice what Elisha does here in 2 Kings chapter 4. In verse 32 beginning, it says, when Elisha came into the house, there was the child lying dead on his bed. And he went in, therefore, he shut the door behind the two of them. And again, he prayed to the Lord. He prayed to the Lord. He was not the Lord. He was a prophet. He prays to the Lord. And he went up and lay on the child and put his mouth on his mouth, his eyes on his eyes, his hands on his hands. It's like he just stretches himself out upon the child. And it says the flesh of the child became warm. And he returned and walked back and forth in the house and again went up and stretched himself out on him. And the child sneezed seven times. Sneezed seven times. Yeah, achoo, achoo, achoo. You know, I can hear you. I find that funny too, though, when I read that. And he called Gehazi and said, call this Shunammite woman. And so he called her. And when she came into him, he said, pick up your son. So she went in, fell at his feet, and bowed to the ground, and then she picked up her son and went out. That sounds pretty similar, doesn't it? Again, we have a deceased child. We have the prophet coming. The son is healed. He tells the mother, he says, I want to give your son back to you, and he does. So in this text, Elisha the prophet prayed to the Lord. The Lord raises the Shunammite's, again, only son from the dead. Now, imagine you're a Jew, you're raised in Old Testament scripture, you see Jesus do something quite similar to what Elijah and Elisha had both done. What would be your conclusion? Your conclusion is naturally what their conclusion is in verse 16. It says, a great prophet has risen up among us. Now, this conclusion is true. Jesus was a great prophet, but I do want you to see that there is a slight difference between the miracles of Elijah and Elisha and that of Jesus. Do you see what the slight difference is? Elijah and Elisha, both of them, when you look at 1 Kings 17, verse 20, 2 Kings chapter 4, verse 33, they prayed to the Lord, asking the Lord to help heal the sick and deceased child. But you know what Jesus says? Young man, I say to you, arise. Why is that distinction significant? Because Jesus was the Lord. He did not need to ask the Lord to raise up this child. He had the power to do it himself. Did you notice, by the way, a small detail, which may be easily overlooked? I overlooked it until somebody showed it to me as I was listening to other people speak on this topic this week. But Luke personally uses a word in this text to describe Jesus for the first time in his gospel. You know what the word is? It says, verse 13, when the Lord saw her. That's the first time Luke himself calls Jesus the Lord. Jesus calls himself Lord in other passages. Other people call him Lord in quotations, but this is the first time that Luke calls Jesus from his own narrative Lord. Because Jesus had the power to raise the dead, he also had the right to tell the widow, do not weep. Because he is the very one who can ultimately remove the tears from our eyes and turn a hopeless situation into a hopeful one. And that should give us great hope as we're here today. Revelation chapter 21, this is why Lewis read this passage. Lewis said he got excited when he was supposed to read this passage. He thought I was preaching on Revelation 21 today. I'm not. I'm just referring to it. We'll do that another day. But Revelation 21, verses 4 and 5. This is why this text right here is one of the most hopeful, encouraging texts that you can read. It says, God will wipe away every tear from their eyes. Jesus had the right to say, do not weep. And the widow had a reason to quit weeping. And in this passage, what we learn is that because of Jesus, we have hope. And because we have hope, we no longer need to cry. There shall be no more death, no more sorrow, no more crying. There should be no more pain. I know people that are going through an incredible amount of pain. They're having a hard time coping with it. Some of you are here today, now. You're going through this type of pain, grief, sorrow, and it's because of death. And I think you're here because you know there is one person who can do something about that. Not just today, not just here, but and for all of eternity, and that's Jesus Christ, who had the power to say, young man, I say to you, arise, and who could rightfully tell the widow, don't cry. Don't cry, because I can do amazing things. I can make all things new. This same Jesus who told the widowed mother, don't weep, told the dead boy, arise, he's still doing the same thing today. He has the power to wipe away our tears, because he has the power to grant new life and to raise the dead. So as we conclude, I want you to just reset the scene at Nain. I want you to think about something as we finish here. Because we need to not just consider the historical events that occurs here with Jesus and the widow at Nain and the young boy. We need to consider the fact that we are all in one of two crowds. There's two crowds here. And each of us today is in one of those two crowds. Some are following Jesus already. You are trusting and growing in his soul-sustaining words. You're finding your hope and your joy in him. But some of us are in a crowd that is just shuffling its way ever closer to death with each passing step, lives that are full of hopeless grief. And I pray today that your path has intersected with the hope-bringing Savior. And if that's the case, I want you to know that Jesus can raise you. He can turn your tears into smiles. He can give us a second chance so that one day he can present us in heaven to the Father for all of eternity. I wonder sometimes when I read this, my mind goes wondering. I need to start keeping a list of things that I want to ask God when I get to heaven. Because the text here doesn't tell me. It just says that he who is dead sat up and began to speak. And I'm sitting here saying, well, what did he say? What's the first thing he said after he's been dead for a day? He's being reunited with his mom. You know, hey, mom, you guys can go home now. I can walk. What'd he say? I don't know. But one thing that I sure hope, I hope he did good with the second chance he had and with a new lease on life. You have the opportunity, because God raises you from the deadness of your sins and your dead lives, you have the opportunity for a second chance in life, a clean slate. And when we realize the amazingness of that, that the past can be put in the past and we can have a second chance to start over again, it should fill us with purpose and rekindle our lives with joy and with hope. And that hope is only found in him, the one who overcame death. And so, are you ready to start with that second chance he's given you? One day, I'm going to conclude with this verse, John 5, 28 and 29. One day, Jesus said to the boy in Luke 7, arise. Arise. John 5, 28 and 29 says that depending upon which crowd you're in, this is what Jesus is going to say. One day, the hour is coming, Jesus says, in which all who are in the graves will hear his voice and come forth. Those who have done good to the resurrection of life, those who have done evil to the resurrection of condemnation. I ask you, which crowd are you in? Because one day you will hear his voice and he will say, arise. And depending upon which crowd you're in, that's going to determine as to which resurrection you're going to have.